This is the Average Guy Network, and you have found Home Gadget Geek show number 686 with guest Phil Hawthorne, recorded on July 30th, 2026. Here on Home Gadget Geeks, we cover all the favorite tech gadgets that find their way into your home. News, reviews, product updates, and conversation, all for the average tech guy. I'm your host, Jim Carlson, broadcasting live from the AverageGuy.tv studio. And maybe a stormy Bellevue, Nebraska, may have some severe weather coming in. Phil, my home assistant automation kicked in about 2 hours ago, started charging the batteries up because the warning's pretty cool, right? I mean, Phil.
Yeah, that is awesome. I've heard that when you mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, that is a fantastic automation to have.
Could I port that? Okay, I've written that. Let's be clear. AI wrote that, right? Yeah, all that integration. With Home Assistant, and we'll talk more about this. I know I'm jumping right in, but I got you. Could I port that out? Can I port those automations out and give them to other people and they would work? I know it wouldn't work exactly like mine because I have certain batteries and other things, but is that possible in Home Assistant?
Yeah.
I never even thought about that.
So Home Assistant have blueprints. They call them blueprints. And you can essentially take out all your entity IDs and put the placeholders in them. And you can then export that out and share it on GitHub. There's also a dedicated, on the Home Assistant community forums, there's a blueprints sub-forum there where people can share blueprints.
Okay.
You can then, in your Home Assistant instance, you would go into create an automation, and one of the prompts will be, do you want to start from a blank automation, or would you like to import a blueprint? And so you would find a blueprint on GitHub, find a blueprint on the forums, just point the link from the topic into Home Assistant, and it will then sketch out that automation for you, and it will have places where, okay, now you need to select your weather entity. Now you need to select your switch to turn on the power charging.
Right.
And the blueprint author can get pretty fancy and actually restrict what type of entities you want to specify where. So, you know, instead of having to select, you know, from a random sensor, you can actually choose only show weather entities when they're selecting if it's raining or if it's sunny. There's a whole bunch of, like, people have done some pretty cool stuff with blueprints. Like, there is a random Philips Hue Zigbee remotes that have button presses. So there's blueprints out there where you can actually go, okay, when I do a long press, do this. When I do a short press, do this. Rather than having to find the Zigbee event IDs or go in and find the right place, you can just go click, done. When I long press this, do that action.
Nice. Okay. I'm not going to do it. I'd get Gavin to do it for me.
Absolutely. Get Gavin to do it. Or yeah. Gavin's AI to do it.
That's exactly. Isn't Gavin AI? Now that I know what I know about AI, I think he's been AI the whole time. Don't you think?
Gavin is a service, surely.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he's an AI for sure. Well, Phil, hang tight. We'll come back to you. I got you talking before I even introduced you, but we'll get to Phil here in just a second. We'll have lots of great show notes tonight. Check them out, theaverageguy.tv. Big thanks to our Patreon subscribers. If you have been on that team, thank you. We've got one plan. It's $5 a month. Super simple. 1 month or many months, theaverageguy.tv/Patreon if you want to join that team. And then big thanks to many of you using the Amazon affiliate link pass through at theaverageguy.tv. Just head out there, upper right-hand corner. You'll see a little, this helps via Amazon. Click on it, pass through. You guys know the routine. Thanks for those of you who've been doing it as well. Phil Hawthorne is hanging out with me tonight. Home Assistant, or the Home Assistant podcast, I should probably say. All things smart home as well. Phil, welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's so good to finally be here.
Yeah, great to have you. Hey, talk us for folks who have no idea. I mean, we talk Home Assistant, so it's not it's not a foreign concept. But for folks who maybe haven't listened to the Home Assistant podcast, give me your quick elevator speech on it. Why should they go out and listen?
Okay, we are my co-host Rohan is in Canada. I'm in Australia. Every basically 4 times a month, we're doing a release when we're just talking Home Assistant. So if you're interested in the smart home and Home Assistant, come check us out. We'll break down every release. So Home Assistant do a monthly release where they're talking about what those changes are, how they can affect you. And we're also got, we're also talking to the community. So if you're using Home Assistant, come on, talk to us. Like I'm talking to Jim right now. Share your story. We have some fantastic guests from the guy that's never done coding before, people that you know, are blind and using Home Assistant, creating their own automations. I think one person was automated their cat litter and robot vacuum cleaners, right? Like it's, we're just here to share and geek out about Home Assistant and how to use it, right? So yeah, come listen to, if you're looking for inspiration, come check us out.
Yeah, we'll have links. I interrupted you. Say that one more time, Phil.
Homeassistant.fm.
Okay, perfect. I'll have it in the show notes so you can head out there and check that out. What about All Things Smart Home? You want to pimp that really quick?
We tried to start another Home Assistant is very specific. We tried to start another podcast in the more generic smart home space, but time, right? And now we're doing 4 episodes a month of Home Assistant. Okay. Time gets tricky.
Gets harder, right? That second podcast, everybody was like, oh, this would be a great idea. And then you start doing this is actually a lot of work.
It's
to get it done. So you can check. I'll have links to both of those podcasts out there. Phil, you mentioned we're going to spend a lot of time tonight talking about Home Assistant. There'll be things woven in. So as you're listening to this, stay around. We'll have a lot of stuff mixed in. You guys talk about releases, and I've never really tracked the Home Assistant releases. I've been using some version of Home Assistant for 8 years. Is that safe to say? Like, it's been out there a while, right?
Over 10 years. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. A long time. The early versions were tough for me. They just were hard, right? They were hard. Mm-hmm. And even up until I started using AI, I'm not sure I got the full functionality out of Home Assistant. I don't really track. We're going to talk a little bit about AI a little bit later, but I don't really track the releases. But as I was getting ready to have you on, I was doing a little review of what you guys were talking about. And there were two things that kind of stood out in some of the releases that are happening right now. One was around automations. So this was what was hard about Home Assistant. It was horrible to try to write automations to, right? And then the second one was IR, which I was kind of like, what? Okay, so let's talk about the automations first, and we'll come back to the seriously IR in 2026.
I know. I think I had the same reaction.
I think it has some applications though, as I was doing some work. Talk a little bit about the internal automation space for Home Assistant and what it's doing. Just talk about some of the new stuff.
So ever since inception, right, day dot, Home Assistant has always been entity first. And I mean entities that, you know, you have a light bulb that has several values. It has its brightness value. How bright is that light bulb? What's the state of that light bulb? Is it on or off? So there's two entities for one device just there. Home Assistant has always been focused on automating against those entities. So if you want to turn a light bulb on, you would have to know the entity of that light bulb, its on and off state. If you want to set its brightness, you would have to then go in and find the brightness value and adjust that. Now, Home Assistant is moving away from, okay, this is my light bulb. I want it to turn on when this happens. We're now moving more to I think Frank describes it as purpose-specific triggers and automations. So you have a purpose. When I walk into a room, the lights in that room should turn on. And Home Assistant has been slowly chipping away at this. If you go back through the releases over the past couple of years, you'll see that it's all been building to this. And it is a fundamental change for the way Home Assistant automations are done. They've added in the concept of rooms and areas so that now you can group, you know, a light bulb belongs in this room as opposed to just a light bulb sitting somewhere in a random group. Mm-hmm. So areas are now first-class citizens as opposed to a random group of things. You've got labels against items now, so you can label things like accent lights, down lights, you know, what's the actual lighting that you want to control. So now with these purpose-specific triggers and automations, you can actually target devices in a whole area at once, and you can also target motion sensors in a room. So you could define that a motion sensor is in a room, and now you can have things where if I walk into a room and any of those motion sensors are on, turn on the lights, all the lights in that room. And this is something that was really challenging beforehand. You would have to do a combination of calling all those individual lights directly. You would have to create helper entities, like bringing all those motion devices into one virtual device. Now you've got the ability to just define them in an area, and those automations don't have to change. Those automations are, if the room is occupied, turn on the lights. And you can switch out those lights, switch out those motion sensors. As long as they're tagged in the right area, those automations don't need to change anymore, which there's half a problem, right? Automations mm-hmm. getting broken because things are changing. Device, you've brought in your IKEA bulb and now it's got a different entity ID. Now all your automations have to be updated. Not anymore. So yeah, it's a big change. I think a change in the right direction, particularly if we want to get more people into Home Assistant, not just technically minded.
Yeah, just not the geeks, right? From that standpoint.
Yeah.
Do you think they're following? I mean, certainly, you know, I was early on Hue and have been Tapo, which D-Link, Tapo, like they've had 4 or 5 different platforms, right? And they were early in the group space. Like as we think about creating a group or groups that are defined by an area, right? They were early in that. Home Assistant's been a little late, I think, and kind of, is that just because of the starting one direction and then it takes a while to move the community and get everybody? Is that kind of, would that be a safe assessment?
I think, well, Home Assistant, I mean,
they've always had groups. I mean, they've always had areas, right? But yeah, go, sorry.
Yeah, areas like fairly new. They've always had groups back in, before you could do automations in the interface and you were doing them only in YAML, the only way you could sort of make an interface in Home Assistant was to put devices into a group, into a YAML group. And I think trying to sort of keep that YAML around, which is still available, that sort of just became the de facto way of doing things until it's sort of been like, well, hang on, no, we can do this better. Let's think of a new way to do it. Home Assistant has also gone really deep into devices over entities. So instead of grouping things in a random group for all your devices that are similar, now you have a device and we can do things like, what is a model number of that device? Does it have a software update? What's all of its attributes and entities under it? What services does it have? You know, some is particularly in the Z-Wave and Zigbee space, you can ping devices to see if they're still online. So now you can have those as attributes of the device as opposed to a random service that isn't related at all. And that becomes important, particularly as we're now moving towards a device-centric and area-centric sort of way of thinking of the smart home.
Yeah. Bringing my batteries in, those have, and I think, so correct me, it's okay to correct me if I say the wrong word, but we have a device and it has many entities. And those, right, those entities are all the functions of the battery. So on and off. I mean, I have AC in, DC in, AC out, DC out.
Yeah.
All the lights, different charging modes, right? Or in the early days, we had lights and we were turning them on and off, right? Basically, right? Your light is on, your light's off. Is some of this, when we think about Home Assistant having to now deal with these explosion of entities inside of each device, Is that getting better in the way they handle it and the way they show it? And to me, it seems like it makes a lot more sense today than it ever has. Would that be a safe assumption?
Absolutely. So previously, when you would bring in those devices, it would have a whole bunch of just random sensors, and they weren't linked to anything. Now, with devices being the central container of all them all, we know that they've got a relation to that device. And Home Assistant also, now that there is a device, it knows what's important and what's not important. So if you were to add a Zigbee device to your Home Assistant instance, it would have sensors like, what's this radio strength frequency, right? Mm-hmm. Previously, they would always be available. They would take up space. Now they are disabled by default. And when they're disabled, they're hidden. So they're still available. If you want to go hunting for them at the device layer, you can bring them back alive. But by default, random entities like that are disabled. They're hidden unless you need them for a specific reason.
I mentioned we talk about AI a little bit later, but let me bring it in because I think for my average users who are listening to this, you know, they want to use Home Assistant. It's been hard. It's not, you know, the install is easy. Getting it set up, even in a Docker space, pretty easy. Getting it running, it finds a lot of things now kind of natively. But man, the AI tools have made this incredibly simple now. What in your, as you're thinking about this, I mean, you guys have been developing on this, working on it. Gavin, who's come on, talked about, you know, yeah, I'd write this code, right? I'm all of a sudden doing a ton of this just by, you know, speaking the truth. Like, hey, I want this. And it's like, hold my beer, you know, and watch this on the AI. Is this starting to change for, you know, you work in this development space and with Home Assistant. Is this changing the community? And how is that community responding to, and I don't want to call it a threat, but to the AI help that's coming now. Like, hey, I used to have to hard code. You know, it's like us podcasters. Oh, I had to hard code an RSS feed. You know, you and I didn't, but there's some that did, right? Is there a response in the community at all to negatively to AI on some of this? Like, you're not doing it the right way, so to speak.
No, I haven't seen much negative response to AI in Home Assistant. In fact, Home Assistant are very AI positive, I would say. A whole bunch of work that's gone into the Home Assistant side of things this year has been upgrading their documentation. And this is something that Home Assistant has had a lot of flack for. Like, they've been told, you know, documentation sucks. It's holding back people from coming onto the platform. Well, now there's been a very big focus on upgrading all of that documentation, especially for the AI era, because not only are humans reading our documentation for Home Assistant, but AI is. And if AI is getting the wrong information, that's, you know, garbage in, garbage out, essentially. And
It's funny you say that with documentation, because I've always actually been impressed by, I can go and, like, I can get a new device and I put the device name and Home Assistant in, you know, in a Google search, and it takes me right to this wiki style page that's actually got all the integrations built in. It's got, like, here's what this supports. Here's the versioning associated with it. There's a button you can click to install it in on Home Assistant, right? So that's not good enough for the, like, I mean, I've always been impressed with the documentation.
You have to remember that's taken 10 years to get to.
Okay.
And it hasn't come overnight.
For sure. Yeah.
And with purpose specific triggers, there was a very concerted effort from day, like from when it was released, they weren't going to say it was ready until they had every trigger, every condition documented, and also documented in a way that you may not see when we're viewing it, but in the back end that LLMs can actually read it as they need to read it or they need to interpret it, because they won't see necessarily the web page that we're scrolling through.
Yeah. I did notice, I think at some point in time I used it for a while and then I stopped, and then I'm like, oh, I'm going to come back to this. Maybe it's about the time I started having Gavin back on the program, was like, oh, maybe I should try Home Assistant again, right? And I just noticed that the documentation, maybe over the last 5 years, has gotten significantly better, right? More helpful with that. Along those lines, I'm also seeing additional integrations by both organizations that own these smart devices and developers who are bringing, you know, special integrations in that maybe are not being developed. I think my Blue Yeti and EcoFlow batteries are both not supported necessarily. They're not from the manufacturer, right? They're developers who are doing this. Is that, talk a little bit about that community. Is me saying it's gotten more prevalent, is that true? Is it getting better support for all these other devices that are out there?
Oh, so I think there's two stories here. Home Assistant now has its Nebucasa commercial side relationship. And I know when that was released, some people thought, oh, that's just the Home Assistant team, like, sort of cashing in. I think we're starting to see the fruits of that labor now, though, because now there is a commercial entity that gives Home Assistant some official channels to communicate with other commercial entities. We're seeing the Works with Home Assistant program now, where companies can get certified that their products are going to work with Home Assistant. And that also formalizes partnerships. So it's no longer a random guy creating an integration into Home Assistant. It's now, here's two companies communicating, they've got contracts signed with each other, they're agreeing, you know, that this is, they're going to support the community in this regard. So I think,
Nothing wrong with a guy.
No.
Like I said, the two I use are a guy doing this, and it's actually getting regular updates, and they're strong. Like, so nothing wrong with that. But it, with the corporate integration, I am sure it helps with the development too, right?
Yeah. And honestly, it's like, so I have LG devices in my home, but I use Home Assistant as my shopping list, right? If I'm going to bring a new device into my home, it's not Home Assistant, I'm not going to consider it, right? LG has two integrations. One was created by a community member and it's been fantastic. But now LG have seen, oh, actually, there's a lot of people using our API outside of our app. Oh, what's this Home Assistant thing? LG have come to the party and said, well, let's create our own official integration. So now there's a community version of the integration and the official supported integration from LG. Not every company is like that, I will say. Some companies have gone the opposite direction and restricted their API access. Jim, I don't know if you've seen in the past couple of days, I think Samsung SmartThings are now putting a fee up on their API now. I know a lot of people that have Home Assistant migrated away from SmartThings, integrating SmartThings with Home Assistant so they don't have to bring those devices from SmartThings over to Home Assistant.
Yeah.
It's sad, but this is the point for Home Assistant, you know?
Yeah.
Break down these walls and pay
right,
walls.
Right. No, and I think I have a Miros garage. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but Miros garage door opener. And they don't have an integration, but there's two actual integrations with that and that are independent, you know, guys doing it. So I installed them both and neither of them worked for me right off the bat. And I'm like, okay, I'm not doing something right. I'll come back. A day later, I came back. Both of the integrations had, like Home Assistant had found both of them, enabled them, and they were working. And I'm like, oh, well, this is handy. Like, I must not have been clicking the right buttons to begin with, or maybe it just took some time for those pieces to come in. So I checked out both and disabled one, and it's working great inside Home Assistant. So sometimes that happens too. I find, I get the app installed, and it's all, sometimes it's right away, but sometimes it takes a little time for the integration to show up. Is that fairly normal or?
Yeah, it depends how fast, like if it's a Wi-Fi device and Home Assistant scanning the network, maybe it's, you know, hasn't scanned, done its daily scan yet, or you haven't rebooted Home Assistant for it to an initial scan of devices. Generally, like I found, like it found, as you said, like, it just finds random things. Like I'll be, I've got a Withings sensor, like a temperature sensor. And my son had a fever the other day, took his temperature, and I come back into Home Assistant and go, hey, I found this on the network. Would you like to integrate it? Like, I didn't even know it could support that device.
Yeah. Oh, there shoot. Yeah, I forgot. I was going to turn that off, you know, or whatever. Or you're like, one of my recommendations in installing Home Assistant is install it and then walk away from it for a while and just let it run for a day and then come back to it, you know, maybe install it in the morning, come back to it in the evening. And in some cases, depends on how much smart stuff you've bought, it'll have found a whole bunch of stuff on your network. You got to attach it to your network, but it'll find all these things. Zigbee and Z-Wave may be a little bit different in that world because you're going to have to get those things turned on, right, to make some of that work and make that integration work. I mentioned at the top of the show, another thing in the most recent update is some IR support. And I was like, why? Did you have the same response to that? And then
I did actually. It's 2026 and we're talking about infrared again. I thought that had been done and dusted. I thought we were moving away from infrared, particularly it's, you know, not necessarily a two-way communication street. If you think about it, you've got your old school air conditioner controller that, you know, blasts out an infrared to the conditioner. It has to set its temperature, has to send the whole kit and caboodle every time, has to set the timers, everything, all in that single blast. I was really surprised to see it. I was like, well, I was actually struggling to think, what IR device do I have left in my home? I just replaced my air conditioner that's LG, so it's Wi-Fi now. I don't think I have a single IR device that I could use that's not connected to Wi-Fi.
I just bought one of those cooling, you know, window cooling units that has the new technology. So makes them super efficient. It's Wi-Fi enabled and Bluetooth and IR. I was thinking about it as I was doing a little research on that. Cause I asked this question, like, and this was one of the ones I was having a conversation with the AI. I was like, why IR? And it kind of came back saying, you know, not only can it control older devices or devices that are not supported, you know, that may not have that support for Home Assistant that way, but also you can now, those with those remotes, you can now almost, this is almost the reverse of Harmony. You can now assign those remotes to do different things, like your temperature up and down. That up and down can be assigned to something in the remote. So you can kind of turn that remote into a Home Assistant device of some kind, right? Which I found kind of interesting. Well, how's the community? Did everybody kind of go, huh?
Yeah. I think everyone was, oh, okay. And it sort of, We've seen the Bluetooth proxies that I think when Bluetooth came out, everyone was like, oh, Bluetooth's not a smart home protocol. But Bluetooth is now, thanks to ESP Home and those Bluetooth proxies, is now very much his welcome in the smart home. I think IR is going to be on a similar trajectory. It is very early days, though. So currently, there is limited support for IR proxies. Home Assistant has taken the approach of, rather than you teaching your IR proxy the commands, Home Assistant wants to know the commands to send. So it's sort of like wanting to be its own Harmony remote database. Mm-hmm. And At first I was like, oh, that's going to get a lot of negative feedback. And I think it has. People are now restricted in that, okay, I can't just teach my IR proxy what to do. We have to remember this is the very first release. IR proxies were April, I think they came out at. It will improve over time, and I'm sure you'll be able to think you can't do two-way IR anymore. You can't, like, as you just mentioned, tell a remote to broadcast into this proxy and do something. That's not available yet, but hopefully in the future it will be.
I think
having the source of the IR codes in Home Assistant will allow Home Assistant to have more control over and more, a better user experience for people. Right now, you know, I've got an RF, like a Broadlink RF transmitter. An RF, I don't know, it just rolling codes and a whole bunch of rubbish. It's never stable for me. So I'm hoping with Home Assistant having control of the codes, it will make it less fiddly, more stable.
Yeah, I just found it interesting. You said this, like, it's back. Sort of, right? I mean, the other thing, so on my air conditioner, I put a soft start. I put a easy start. I think it's the brand name on it, soft start on my air conditioner outside. And it's got really low power Bluetooth on the thing, right? Only broadcasts when it's the air conditioner is actually turned on. Like, so it has to be physically running, which I thought, guys, it's plugged in. You could probably, you could probably broadcast that thing all the time. They chose not to. It's okay. When I went down the rabbit hole, and this is new to me, these ESP home, like, hubs, we can kind of call them, right? And even my Home Assistant is sitting right here on this laptop that's also got OpenClaw and Hermes and stuff running on it in a Docker. But that Easy Start is literally on the other side of the wall, and I can't reach it from here. It's that low of power. I have to take my phone over to it to even see it. These ESP devices, which are cheap, I think, right? These are low,
$30 or something.
Yeah. I think I saw them for $10 on Amazon here in the US. Sorry, you're in Australia. You pay a little bit.
Yeah, dollaritos.
It's like our Canadian friends. They pay 10 times what we do for stuff. But let's just say it's $15 to $30. That could be a solution for me, right? I could plug that in over in that area, connect it to my Wi-Fi, and Home Assistant would pick up on that and pick up that low power Bluetooth. Is that a safe assumption for me?
Absolutely, yeah. And not only that, you can also then use that proxy for other purposes. Maybe you could have it to, if your phone or Apple Watch isn't closer to it, you could say, oh, okay, Jim's in this room. And then you can have another proxy in another room. Ah, now Jim's in that room. You don't need motion sensors. You just know where you are based on those Bluetooth proxies.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's a huge surprise to me, by the way. I was like, what is this ESP? ESP Home, right, is what it's called.
ESP Home, that's correct.
Like, what is this thing? That's like a whole new world to me. Man. And this kind of opens up some devices that may not normally make it. So with what TJ was talking about last week, right, where his Bluetooth can't make it to from the shed, obviously it's not going to make it from the shed to his house. That's a solution for him, right? That he could put that in.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the whole point of these proxies, because Bluetooth has such a short range. You can leverage Wi-Fi to put those proxies elsewhere. And for all intents and purposes, the Home Assistant just assumes it's plugged in directly to the Bluetooth receiver and it's in the same room. But it could be up in level 3, or it could be out in a garden shed somewhere. Yeah. It doesn't matter. It's as long as Home Assistant can communicate with that proxy, it'll handle it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it certainly opens some things up for me, thinking about, you know, the shed. My shed in the back is the man shed, right? You know, it's the man cave. And also, all of a sudden, you're like, ooh, maybe we get some things out there that would normally reach, you know, there. How long has that been around? Like, how long have I been out of the loop that these
on ESP Home?
Yeah, ESP Home.
ESP Home's been quite some time. We actually interviewed the original creator of ESP Home, which was a young guy. I think it was like he was in uni and created it. Nebuchadnezzar eventually acquired ESP Home and has built it up to as part of the, and then donated it to the Open Home Foundation. It's a bit crazy. There's constant work going on with it.
Bluetooth IR, right? So Bluetooth IR, what else is covered in that?
You've got Wi-Fi, so anything Wi-Fi essentially. Yeah. But the point of it is that you would install it to a chip, and then you can control it with Home Assistant. So you can either do a direct integration with Home Assistant via the Home Assistant API, or you can do an integration with something like MQTT. So you could expose Mosquito and communicate over that protocol to whatever you need to, or you can just run an HTTP. Server on it, right? It's not restricted to Home Assistant. ESP Home is built, you know, open source that anyone can use it. And some companies are using it as well.
Yeah. No, that was a whole new world for me. I was like, what is this? And then all of a sudden I realized, and it's not terribly expensive. There's quite a bit of things you can do with it and super reasonable and not affected by the chip shortage today.
Amazing. Yeah.
Great. Yes. Finally, something not affected by the chip shortage. Okay, speaking of something unique and that we don't get a lot of talk about, you guys were talking about on the podcast e-ink monitors, right? These new style or newish style of e-ink monitors to be a Home Assistant dashboard, so to speak.
Yep.
And I'm intrigued by this. My Home Assistant dashboard, I just actually run on a laptop, right? This laptop that's hosting Home Assistant and Hermes and OpenClaw. I also run the dashboard, but I can run it from anywhere. A lot of folks run these on tablet devices, but what's the advantage of e-ink? Like first of all, I'm intrigued by it. And then I asked the AI, could I get a 24-inch e-ink monitor? And they're like, $2,000. And I'm like, okay, that's not the way to do this. But talk a little bit about the advantage as you're thinking about this. What's the advantage to maybe going with an e-ink device for Home Assistant?
So there's a few. One is you're reducing another screen in the home. I don't know about you, but I've tried the tablets on a wall. It looks like another screen on the wall. Because of the low power usage of e-ink, you could have it to be battery operated. So you don't need to have it plugged in if you don't need to, depending on the frequency of updates you're doing. It's also good for if you don't have a lot of information being broadcast a lot, you could just have, you know, like the daily weather update once a day or your daily calendar, right? Like here's a summary. It looks nicer, I think, visually, as it's not a screen, it looks more permanent. It's meant to be there, right? It is just nicer. Home Assistant or the Open Home Foundation have also started building out what's called Open Display, I believe it's called, which is another project they're working on. Right now, there's all these e-ink display drivers that you can go out and get. You can go and download this software, run your e-ink on that. Home Assistant is trying to make Open Display sort of the standard. So if you do want to publish a dashboard, you want to publish a photo to an e-ink display, Open Display will just handle it, similar to how ESP Home can handle all the proxy stuff for Bluetooth. Open Display can handle all the nuances of actually getting what you want displayed on your e-ink display. And in terms of dashboards, the limit, right? We just had Khalid on the podcast. He's using Grocy tied into Home Assistant to show how many dog treats are in stock in his home. So he can say, okay, yep, I need to go out shopping and get some more of these treats because there's only three left. There's so many use cases for it, right? Like washing's outside, you know, put a card up on an e-ink display to say, don't forget to bring the washing in, dishwasher's run, ready to be emptied.
Sometimes the argument has been energy. And I wanted to argue with you tonight about this energy. I did some math. You know, you think about your average tablet, And it really, in a lot of cases, it runs somewhere between 10 and 25 watts, which if you calculate that over the course of a year, at least in my I did this based on what I pay for electricity. You pay in Australia probably a little bit more. But I'm roughly, it's $1.50 a year to run a tablet, like on all the time. Like the wattage is really, really small on those. But even, say, $5 a year, most people aren't even thinking twice about that. Now, the e-ink is going to be pennies a year, to be honest, right, when we think about that. So, but if you thought $3 a year and the price, but you were buying e-ink, you know, to replace a tablet, you never get that money back for the most part, right? The one thing you did mention, though, is battery. I hadn't thought about this. Like, I could put it on the wall and not wire, right, anything into it. And that would be for the price of copper or whatever, the hassle of wiring. All right, so I can't argue with you because I'm like, yeah, that kind of makes sense, right? It becomes completely independent, so to speak.
I think you've also got to remember that those tablets, if they're on 24/7, you have to then manage the battery swelling and charging and discharging of that battery.
True.
The replacement of that tablet, like Android or iOS updates, eventually that tablet, the operating system behind it, is going to get sluggish. And you're going to have to replace that tablet at some point.
Yeah.
E-ink just being a very dumb display to move sand around the display, surely it doesn't need much tinkering later, right?
Right. You would hope. Do we have much? Are there many stats? Like, e-ink's been around a while now. Any stats on an e-ink screen and how long they make it?
I don't know, actually. That would be interesting.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see what some of those. I love the displays. The market hasn't been giant for them. And so I don't think we're getting the best out of it for whatever reason. If we could figure out a way to make a market for them where there would be some competition, there's just a few companies making them for the most part.
And the price.
I was like, I've got a 24-inch touch screen that I use right here. I don't use it for a lot of touch, but it's 24-inch touch screen. That's a $2,000 e-ink that I can't even buy on the market that I would need to buy from a reseller, right, to get that. And some of those, they're making some of these for like big giant displays, like you'd see in an airport or some of those kinds of things. $10,000 and $30,000 for those.
Yeah,
they're pretty significant, right? When we think about it, so it'd be nice to see some of that technology get cheaper, so that, because I just love I love the look of e-ink.
You know? I don't know if you've seen all the color e-ink that's coming out now. My hope is that as that space evolves, the black and white e-ink will sort of not be in as much of demand, and we'll see some price reduction there.
Would you put e-ink in your car as opposed to like today, you know, I've got a regular monitor, you know, I have a Subaru, 21 Subaru, it's got a 17-inch monitor in there, right?
Yeah.
Set in the wrong orientation, but it works. Would you go color e-ink in your car as opposed to?
I don't think so.
You wouldn't think so?
You'd need a very fast refresh rate. Like, that information straight away.
I'm thinking about entertainment, the entertainment center side of it, as opposed to the, you know, today and all the electric vehicles, it covers everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that wouldn't be practical.
No way. To get a color picture, right, it takes, you know, can take a couple of minutes for it to draw, depending on if it's battery powered or hardwired, right?
Right on. No, it makes sense. Okay, you talked me out of that. This is why I asked the experts on it. Hey, let's talk a little bit about when we think about Home Assistant and home automation in general. Is there a difference, you know, as we think about maybe the UK, the US, and the Australian markets, and let's bring New Zealand into the, it's probably an unfair comparison, let's bring New Zealand into Australia, right, from that standpoint. The Kiwis are like,
No, we're different.
But do those markets, when we think about that space, and home automation just is a way to get to it. I mean, yeah, Home Assistant is a way to get to it. Home automation in general. Do you see big differences in those markets?
Only in terms of what's available, in terms of devices, you know, or products. I think, for example, Z-Wave Long Range. available in the US. I think it's just coming to Europe, but there's no talk about it coming anywhere else at the moment. And that's where, you know, Zwave's sort of focusing on. And I'm like, well, I'd love to have long range, you know, and we have very big properties out here in Australia, right? Especially in the rural areas where that would be very advantageous for us. And yeah, I think there's maybe it's a time zone issue for Australia, but you know, sort of this APAC region, we sort of get, we're not close enough to the US time zone, we're not close enough to the European time zone for big announcements, and we sort of get forgotten about. Like we're just, oh yeah, we're just that other region. Like yeah, I think we do get left behind on some of those products.
Do you think Australia is behind the United States then from a product standpoint? Are we getting more products faster than maybe they're getting in Australia?
Or is yes.
It, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Like even when I go to CES, I'll look at a device like, oh, that's so cool. I'm like, does that, are we available in Australia? I'm like, no, sorry.
Like, can you buy it and take it in? Are they pretty restrictive about?
It depends on, if it's a 120 volt product, probably not. But yeah, if I wanted to buy something, I could, work around it.
Right, right. From an adoption standpoint, would you answer that differently as far as the way Australians are adopting versus what's happening here in the US or Canada?
I think it's on path. Australia is a very, we love technology. I mean, Australia basically invented Wi-Fi, if you want to, right? And we are very, we love gadgets, right? We love technology. And I know on the Facebook groups, like those home businesses, we've got Australia-specific Facebook groups, they are busy. Like people are always on those groups talking away with ideas. Europe, I think, is more into DIY ESP home side of things opposed to the US. I think how did Paulus describe it once? The US have a lot of money to spend, like generally the people in the US have a lot more money, so they will go out and buy a product that just works and as of that day. Europeans may not have as much money, will rather try and tinker with whatever they've got to get working. So if that means, you know, hacking a breadboard to get something integrated to Home Assistant so they don't have to buy a whole new product, they'll do it that way. There's some differences there too.
Joe out in chat had said, let me see if I can pull this up. Where'd it go? Let's see. Let me get to his first comment. Sorry, I thought I was ready for this. Actually, there's someone out in chat says, okay, you've convinced me to retry Home Assistant. I really hated all those entities. Joe said out in chat, he said, I have some of those smart plugs that I bought like 10 years ago on sale at Home Depot. Got to digging. They're all ESP 8266 based.
Yeah.
And so he said, pulled them apart, flashed them with some help from the forums. Now they not only have local control with ESP Home, there was unused GIO. I don't know what that is. I used to add temp, humidity sensors.
Yeah. So that would have been like some pins on the board that he could then add in some additional sensors to it. And this is it, right? Like Tasmota, I think, was a very big driving force behind ESP Home too. Like the very early days, you know, there was companies out there that were shipping these boards out there, like in their products, and people realizing, well, hang on, like I don't need to use your cloud service. I can flash this with my own software, put ESP Home on it, and have full control over it. There's no risk that in 5 years' time, when you're not selling enough units and you need to shut down your cloud API, that I can't turn my switches off and on again, which we're seeing, right? Wemo as an example.
Yeah. GeekGuru77 in chat said, he goes, yeah, I got SwitchBot, a BLE push button in the garage and placed a BLE proxy in the garage. Mm-hmm. I live in an apartment on the second floor. Still works great.
Yeah. Right. So this is the power of like when people come together and we create in the open, fun things can happen.
Yeah. Yeah. It does beg a question, right? In this world of open versus closed. And, you know, we mentioned this a little bit earlier when, you know, you said some of these plugins get started open in the open community, and then an organization comes in and says, we're going to close these things up and take them over ourselves. And you mentioned the Samsung. But yet I've seen a lot of good things, like in closed communities, when an organization's controlling, I've seen better control and faster development happen in that case. Like, they get it to market faster. There's no infighting that's going on. Listen, for all these communities, right? There's these, sometimes there's these battles that go on and stuff just sits forever because everybody's infighting about it. Your thoughts, open versus closed? Do you have an opinion? Like, what's better, or you know, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think similar to you, there are advantages to it. I don't know. For me, I would rather it be open, in that if the committee doesn't agree, there can always be a fork of it. Right? Like, there's enough people to start another version of Home Business that wants to take it into another direction. The code's there. Go ahead and do it. You can't do that in a closed system. And I don't think the current model that Home Business has, the Open Home Foundation have, you know, open source, commercial. We come back to Plex when I would talk about Plex in the pre-show, right?
Yeah.
Plex annoys me in that it's my data, it's my media. I don't want to have your media thrown down my throat. And because Plex isn't as open source as that we want it to be, we don't get that. We have to go to Jellyfin or something else, and then even then, it's not the right experience, I think.
It's the cycle. It's the circle of life. I don't know if we can ever get away from this. You know, we get a grassroots movement. It gets popularity.
Yeah. Like,
Unraid is kind of in this space too. Although they're doing a great job with it. I think Unraid might be successfully navigating this open and closed together. Yeah. Like, they seem like they're getting it right. But then something comes along. You know, you mentioned the Open Home Foundation. And trying to get some grasp. Okay, we got to get this figured out. And then eventually it seems like somebody buys it and they're like, okay, we're going to bring this in, and they move fast with it. Mm-hmm. And then they start doing things, charging, or, you know, it's different for every group, right? But they have the opportunity to ruin it. And then a whole bunch of people say they leave, and then they start a whole new group of ground. As we think about 2026 right now, how do you feel like Home Assistant, or maybe just the open home space, is healthy? Are we healthy today? Are we better than we were 5 years ago? I don't know. Your thoughts on when we think about the condition of the open home?
I think much better. And I think thanks to the Open Home Foundation being founded, we are seeing that Home Assistant, along with all the other Open Home Foundation projects. So we've got ZWebJS, ESP Home is also Open Home Foundation project, Music Assistant, heaps of projects now. They're all owned by the Open Home Foundation, which cannot be sold, right? Polis, who created Home Assistant, donated Home Assistant to the foundation. Nabucasa, which is the commercial side of Home Assistant, is a commercial partner of the Open Home Foundation, but has no ownership of it. So even if Paulus, the creator of Home Assistant, wanted to go in that direction, it's not available anymore. Like, Paulus doesn't have control of what he started. Mm. I think that's important. We are seeing a lot more big companies coming to the table now to talk with the foundation and support its mission. You know, like, there's been great donations by DuckDuckGo, for example, into the foundation. There's Nabucasa's got all these commercial partnerships. We've got the Works with Home Assistant program. It is much more official and much more bigger than it was 5 years ago, absolutely, because the foundation didn't exist back then. And I think it's inviting more players to the table as opposed to pushing them away or creating a relationship of an adverse relationship amongst everyone.
With the Works with Apple, Works with the A-Lady, Works, like, all those, does Home Assistant stand a chance to be on that box next to those names, and it matters to people?
I think you're already starting to see it. Acara, they're putting their label, like, they've got the Works with Home Assistant logo right there. There's a few other brands I'm seeing now. We've got smoke detectors. We've got fire products, light bulbs. A whole bunch of companies are now slapping that logo on there. One, they're paying for it. Not a lot of money. Like, the foundation is not looking for a lot of money here. but they're putting like their reputation online and supporting Home Assistant to put that logo on there. Will you see it in a Best Buy scenario? Well, I mentioned Akara. They're in a big companies, right? Like if I go down to JB Hi-Fi now, I can pick up an Akara smart lock and on the box will be works with Home Assistant. I think it's going to take a bit more time. No one has the reach of Google and Amazon and to an extent Samsung with smart things.
Yeah.
I think the tide is turning though, very slowly.
Smart things is a mess, right? Smart things. All I hear is people complain about smart things. Isn't that, I mean, it seems a little messy at this point. Like yes, they own it. Yes, they have it. I don't know if it shows up a lot in people's, I don't hear people necessarily talking about that. I only hear people complaining.
Yeah.
Would that be, yeah, is that kind of true?
Absolutely.
Is that what you're hearing too? Yeah. I do see, you know, and this may be a space when we think about Amazon, this could be, if that could start showing up, and I don't know if they would actively try to block that. They don't seem to, like, yes, they put that on devices, but they don't seem to have a lot of ownership over it. Like, it just shows up because it's convenient, but they don't take a lot of pride in it. They certainly don't advertise it. It's there because it needs to be there.
Yeah.
That may be one of those spaces, at least here in the US, Amazon's so powerful. You know, if it starts showing up in those ads, people might, in the listings, people might be like, oh, yeah. And certainly, do you have any idea of the user base of Home Assistant at this point? I think you mentioned the number earlier.
Yeah. I think, this is hard because Home Assistant is a self-hosted free application, right? Yeah, they're not sure. Tracking sure. Stats. Stats are opt-in. But their current, the last time I checked in, I have to check the latest state of the home. I believe it's north of 2 million homes now powered by Home Assistant, which is amazing if you think about it. Like, project's just over 10 years old, 11 years old, maybe?
Yeah.
12 years old? Yeah. It 2 million homes powered by Home Assistant.
It's pretty good. That's pretty good. I mean, it's pretty good. That's a pretty good base. I'm sure it's more. It'd be hard to track. I think, you know, as I was setting up OpenClaw, I went through three versions of it to get it, like, because I built up, you know, I get this laptop, I built it up, and then I was like,
yep.
I had a Home Assistant on Unraid, so I had it in the Docker in Unraid, and then I was like, well, you know, if I'm going to work with this with AI, I want it to be on the same machine so that we don't have to go back and forth or across the network. And so I set it up on a Docker right on the same machine, right? I tore that thing down three times as I messed up the, you know, as I start doing stuff and I'm like, oh, I don't like this. I just tear it down, rebuild it. AI really, I mean, any of them, I think I've used them all to help with this. This is really the step forward with Home Assistant. Think of what, as you see it from your view, where are we going, or what's the next steps look like in using these AI tools with Home Assistant?
So I think it is inevitable for Home Assistant to become more AI native. We've already seen, as I mentioned before, you know, we've been building to this for quite some time with the areas, the device schemas. Home Assistant has its own model context protocol server, so it can talk the language of AI assistants. You can configure Home Assistant to communicate directly with LLMs. So about a year ago now, I think Home Assistant enabled some AI features. You can go in when you're creating an automation. AI can suggest a name for that automation, can suggest labels for that automation. You can also have, so Home Assistant has its own AI assistant called Assist. Well, an assistant called Assist. You can also back that up with AI. So if you don't have an AI provider, like if you don't have an API key for OpenAI or anything, I like to think of Assist as, remember, like on your phone, you would have like voice commands back in the day, but you had to speak in a very specific command, you know, like turn on Bluetooth or, you know, turn on this light. It had to be the right syntax, right? If you didn't say that, it would be like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. But if you don't have AI tokens behind it, Assist is very similar. You have to structure your sentences. And Home Assistant, once again, they've got their own open source project about decoding sentences to work out what people are trying to say. But if you put some AI tokens behind Assist, we can now, you know, control Home Assistant with AI. You know, you can now talk to Home Assistant and say, hey, turn on this light. And if it can't work it out itself, it'll ask an LLM, what's this user trying to do? And go from there. I think it's,
The difference there is you're using a voice through Home Assistant, right? So you have your Home Assistant instance. You're coming in and invoking a voice assistant through that to make the commands. Is that true?
Voice or text. There, if you look up in the top right-hand corner of Home Assistant, there'll be a little speech bubble. Click that and it'll open up basically a chat window with Home Assistant. Type, you can use voice, whatever you prefer.
Yeah. I remember that was new at one point. Gavin was talking about using that. And I've kind of gone the route of, I don't know why I haven't gone this way, but I've kind of gone the route. I've opened the API for it. So given it the secret. And I've embedded that in OpenClaw. You could do the same thing in Hermes. So basically the same thing. They're a little bit different. They're actually very different, to be honest. But anyways, for this discussion. And then through those, however I'm interacting with, whether I'm on OpenClaw, I haven't opened it up to Hermes. It could get access to it through OpenClaw if it wanted to. I'm able to send prompts in and then say, okay, do these things, create these dashboards. Phil, one of the things that's been maddening to me with the AI is I ask it to create a dashboard and I have to tell it every single time, okay, my Home Assistant's in a Docker, because it tries to do it like it's not. Like it's, and I've been like, can you remember this? Like, write it down somewhere. I'm tired, because it'll try to write to the dashboard and it's like, oh no, there, it's there. And I'm like, no. It's in a Docker, remember? Oh, that's right. In a Docker, it's different. The file structure is a little bit different, right? Oh, that's right. Okay, my bad. All, you know, and it rewrites and it fixes it. So there, it's not always super clean, depending, I guess, maybe I should, well, no, because I want OpenClaw to do the work. So I want it to figure it out, write it down, you know? Are there any other kind of weirdness things you're seeing between, as we're making this transition and interacting with the AI stuff with Home Assistant, things to watch out for when interacting? I mean, we all like to think this is perfect, but it's really not.
It's, no.
Yeah.
I think you described it very well the other day. You've got to give AI, like, you can't, it's not what you want AI to do, it's what you want it not to do as well.
Yeah.
Right. I remember you said that, and that really stuck with
me.
You have to be careful. Like, you have to keep those guardrails.
Yeah.
I would challenge you there. I think you mentioned there, like, OpenClaw. This was my reason why I moved away from OpenClaw to Hermes, because I was finding myself repeating the same instruction over and over again to OpenClaw. I was like, no, look up like five messages. We had already discussed this.
Right.
Hermes, for me at least, I can see I have the, when it messages me, it tells me when it's updating its memory. And when it's updating its skills and stuff, I just teach it skills. And I've told my Hermes instance that I have a Home Assistant that you need to SSH in to this address. You've got Home Assistant running as a VM on Proxmox. These are your file paths, and I've never had to correct it. Right? So
okay, I'll have to try. Maybe that's. I've turned Hermes just into my YouTube content manager, right? So learn everything there is to know about YouTube content. I want to be the smartest person in the world when it comes to YouTube stuff, and help me post and update my YouTube channels. And it's actually been pretty good at it. It's, I'll be honest, it ran away on me one time, but it did some stuff. Stop. I didn't mean it. I didn't mean it that way.
There's no undo button, right?
I need to, one of the things I've actually done is mix the Hermes and OpenClaw file structures. So they live on the same, they actually physically live on the same drive, and have told them both that there are other, like, you have a roommate, you know, kind of thing. And your roommate is OpenClaw to Hermes. Your roommate's OpenClaw. Its files are there. You can inspect them and know what's there and about them. I'm not actually sure that paid off really well, because it got super confused about the way, you know, you have to send an OAuth validation to YouTube all the time to be like, okay, I am me, which is smart, right? It's security for all that stuff. But I think Hermes came up with its own way to do it. And then OpenClaw came up with its own way to do it. And then I think they were fighting each other. And then sometimes I would be like, hey, can you do this? And it's like, oh yeah, that doesn't work anymore. I'm like, what do you mean it doesn't work anymore? You know? So that may have been a mistake on my part, right? To give them both OAuth access on the same machine.
I have a couple of thoughts for you on this. Yeah, I've been listening to you talking about this setup for a past couple of weeks. I'm like, oh, I need to tell Jim this. One, I don't think the OAuth issues you're having with YouTube are specific to OpenClaw or Hermes. I think that is a restriction on YouTube's side. Even today, as we're doing this recording, I had to re-authenticate Restream with my app. On our YouTube channel, I use a service called vidIQ. And we've only been using that for a month, but every time I log in and it has read access to our YouTube channel, but then I go to make an update that it recommends, I have to re-authenticate. Mm. And I suspect it is a YouTube setting.
Restriction.
Restriction, because you know, YouTube gets all those Elon Musk crypto scams all the time.
Yeah.
I suspect YouTube has just tightened down their APIs and apps so that you always have to re-authenticate. I have the same issue with, I have our YouTube account hooked up with N8N, which is a fantastic automation tool. If you haven't used it, get on it. And once again, I have I think every day at 9 a.m., I have a uptime Kuma check. Is the Google authentication to YouTube broken? And if it is, send me a message so I go and authenticate it again. Because it will, without fail, break.
Yeah, it breaks all the time. It's maddening.
The only one I've been able to get around was with Hermes. I had it hook into my Google Calendar, and that would break as well. Once a week, I'd have to go and re-authenticate it. I spoke to ChatGPT, and it told me if I make the app public, but only one user uses it, it doesn't need to be re-authenticated. So now I have my Hermes app public, but only I'm the only sole user of that app.
Okay.
I don't need to have that restriction anymore. I don't think that applies to YouTube though, because those other tools are much bigger than my single Hermes app, still need to be re-authenticated.
It's a mess at times. Like because you got to give it a secret, and it's actually gone through like three different iterations of how it wanted to do the reauthorization. It was like,
yeah,
let me try this way. And then I did it. No, that didn't work. We'll go this way. And then no, that didn't work. And I got a way that was working, and I'm like, okay, do not forget how to do this. I do not.
Yeah.
Yes, I was gritting my teeth as I was typing those. Do not forget how to do this. The next couple of days, it was trying to do it the old way. And I'm like, what what are you doing? I told you not to do it that way.
You're reliving my OpenClaw experience. Like, this was my exact issue. So my other suggestion to you is, you mentioned that you've got OpenClaw and Hermes working on the same, same system.
Same box.
Set up another Hermes profile and then tell Hermes to talk to that other profile and just cut out OpenClaw in my, that's how I've been able to do it.
Shh, don't say it to me. They're listening.
You may be listening. I've had a lot of success. So I have a personal assistant, Hermes profile set up, which has access to my Google Calendar. And then I have another profile set up like you, specifically for podcast, right? And helping me publish the podcast on time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If I need something on my calendar, like there's a recording coming up, in the background, Hermes has a Kanban board, so it can actually delegate tasks to other sub agents or profiles. So now my podcast profile can say, okay, I need to block out this time on Phil's calendar. Go and add an event to my personal assistant and sign it to my personal assistant who has the OAuth credentials into my Google Calendar, and they will then create an event in my calendar. And the podcast doesn't have access to my calendar. It doesn't need access, but it knows how to create a calendar event through my assistant on his own back channel.
Yeah. Listen, Gavin, when we started talking a couple of weeks ago, Gavin was like, I just treat them all individuals.
Yeah.
You know, and that was like, for me, that kind of pushed me over the edge. In fact, I was just talking to my manager at work about this today. Of even at work, we've got access to, you know, Copilot and Claude and OpenAI, ChatGPT. And I've got Perplexity. I've got a bunch of them. And I think even at that level, I treat them all with the different roles. So I'm like, okay, ChatGPT has got this role with me. I trust Claude to do these kinds of things for me. And that's just helped kind of separate it all out. I've actually considered, you know, nothing's permanent, right? So I've actually considered spinning up multiple Dockers and having more than one and getting those definitions, like you're saying, getting those highly defined roles into each one of those.
Well, I did go down that route to save you some time.
Yeah.
Hermes have profiles built in. You don't need to run multiple Docker containers. Within one Docker container, you can run multiple Hermes profiles, and then they can all communicate with each other on a back. Kanban's built into Hermes, basically.
How are you interfacing with it? Like, what's your interface? What are you using to interface with it?
Telegram. Found that to be fantastic.
Okay. My Telegram's all messed up. I need to get, it's one way at the moment. I hear from them. They're not hearing from me.
They're not hearing from you. Wow.
And it's okay. Cause I'm interfacing, like, actually the GUI, it's not really GUI, but you know, you just go in and put Hermes in at the command line. I actually find that really refreshing because it's just basic and simple. Can type commands in. I can control it. I get good feedback from it. That's been my interface to that. I use the web UI for OpenClaw, but because that's okay too. Although it's busy, and in the early days it was messy. It's gotten better. They've gotten better as they've been developing those. But I need to have a talk with both of them and say, "Hey guys, we got to fix Telegraph, Telegram." Sorry, is it Telegram?
Yeah, Telegram. Yeah.
We got to fix that. I only use it for that. And we got to fix this. So let's get this working. Although, I don't know if I want to talk to it that way. I kind of like the control I have right now.
Through the command line.
Yeah. Sitting here through the command line. It's only working. Here's what, you know, and you do software development, so you're busy all day. My fear is that it'll interrupt me during the day and I'll go down a rabbit trail that, you know, like 2 hours later, I come out and I'm like, oh, I should have, you know, type deal. Ruined my day, so to speak, you know.
So I find the opposite. I find having Telegram connected to Hermes to save me I just added a feature, thanks to Hermes, that we have Bunnings, which is our Home Depot, Hammer Barn, if you watch Bluey. That's our hardware store, right? And whenever I go, it's such a big store, I never remember what to come out with, right? Like I go for a specific thing and I just won't buy it. I'll buy 10 other things that I don't need. So I said to my Hermes agent, I'm like, you know what? Let's add a specific to-do list in Home Assistant. We'll call it the Bunnings shopping list. And we'll set up a zone around my local Bunnings. And I'll tell you I need something from the hardware store and you'll add it to the list, right? So now I could just talk into Telegram with my voice and say, and then it will transcribe it and add that to the Home Assistant list. It doesn't message me unless I need an action, right? But otherwise, I'll be just like, you know what? I need silicon. Add silicon to the shopping list, to the Bunnings, to the hardware list. It's added. It's forgotten about.
Well, in the early days, I set up all the alerts. Like, I wanted to know what it was thinking. So I was like, always talk to me through Telegram. And then I regret that now because I get a lot of messages through it. I start ignoring them now because there's just too many.
That's the issue. Yeah.
So I need to get control. Yeah, I need to get control back over again. Any other advice you can give me?
Yeah, check out the Hermes dashboard. The Hermes have their own UI now. Similar to OpenClaw, it's probably going to be, might be a lot of buttons and dials everywhere, but, you know, you can chat with it.
Yeah.
All right there. Yeah. And it'll have all your profiles there.
I have not done voice with either one of those. I'm a big voice user for ChatGPT and for Claude. I'm on voice all the time, but I just haven't, I don't know. It's weird. When I'm sitting here, I don't do voice. Isn't it weird? I podcast here. I talk to this mic all the time. I could easily just jump on and have a conversation with him. But when I'm sitting in this location, I'd rather just type it. And then
that's true. Yeah, I'm the same. I prefer to type out my message, right? When I'm talking, sometimes I'll be thinking, and by the time I finish my voice message, I've said the opposite of what I started with or what I intended to. When you type, you know, you're very clear in what you want. I have got two-way voice going. It will transcribe what I say, but it doesn't have a voice that it talks back to me with.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with that. I don't want it to necessarily have a voice.
Yeah. The I've used both voice on the iPhone for both Claude and ChatGPT. And ChatGPT just did a bunch of updates, and the new voices are freaky. Oh, gosh. They are freaky. Like, I had to say, stop. Stop. Mm-hmm. Like, what happened? What happened to my friend? What did you do? Did you kill and bury my friend? Because I've been talking to this guy for the last 3 months. We've become, you know, we've become friends, super helpful. He's like my engineering brain when I'm, when I have hard things I need to think about. And the new voice is like, what's happening, man? Oh. Like, what?
All what the interruptions. You? Like, I'll be talking, like trying to explain what I want to do. And then it would be like, Oh, right. Okay. Like, don't do that. Don't talk to me, because maybe this is our problem that we've been used to AI assistants. When they would start talking back to you, we assumed that they had, they assumed that we had finished talking, right? Yeah. And then they would come out with their answer. I don't want you to interrupt me. I just listen to me and then talk.
Yeah. I think one of the things is I've been writing more to them at work. I almost say confirm, like I'm like, I want you to do this, confirm, like to get it to even in my own brain to be like, I'm not actually asking you to do anything yet. I want you to dialogue with me.
What would you do
first? Yeah. Cause sometimes I've said things and then they just take off, you know, and you're like, whoa, right? And I'm trying to get, you know, it's almost like with Rocky in Project Hail Mary, where he says question, or he says statement. You know, we almost need some kind of commands that are just like, hey, I'm thinking about this. Just confirm it. The other thing is that wake command would start command would keep them from interrupting, you know? Because I've had that too, where I'm thinking through something and I'm like, okay, just give me a second. Don't talk. I've actually had to say that. It started. I'm like, stop. I'm still talking. Just wait. And then, you know, finished my thought on the thing. We almost need, like, put it in a mode where you say, now it's your turn. You know, because it can't watch body language. It doesn't have the ability. I mean, it could, but it doesn't.
Maybe that's next year's version.
Right? Yeah. Well, who knows? Phil, thanks for coming on. It's great having you here. As we think about the rest of 2026, 2027, you've probably got an eye on what's happening here in the future with Home Assistant. What are you excited about? Like, what's on the horizon that gets you excited about the platform?
Well, I think it's making it more open and accessible to everyday people. Home Assistant 2026.8 is launching next week. We're recording this on Thursday, so August release already. Can't believe that. There's going to be some big changes in terms of accessing Home Assistant. There's no magic ports anymore. You can configure the ports. We are slowly getting towards, you know, the ability where you could give this to your mum or your grandparents, maybe.
You get think to put so?
In their home, right?
Do you?
I like to think so. I would hope
really
so.
Though. I mean, really, like I don't know. I think I don't know. I'm skeptical.
I think that should be the goal. If we get 90% of the way there, that is an achievement.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that should be the goal.
Do you think they need a simple version of it? Like, this is always the problem with these kinds of softwares, right? They're made, the geeks are the ones giving the feedback. And so they make them infinitely configurable and infinitely powerful and infinite. And I always say options equal confusion. This is the problem with the average guy is we have too many options. You're like, we just moved over to Zoom. I shouldn't say we moved over to it, but we just got access to Zoom events at work.
Yeah.
And the Zoom events platform is awesome. It's also a million options. Like, you're like, okay, where do I go if I just want to schedule this thing? Like, okay, I got to remember. It's like 11 or 12 on the toolbar, and each one of those toolbars has 15 different, and then some of those have 5 going across of options, right? And you're like, I think we're going to have to come up with a way simpler version that, like, the average person could use. My mom would not use this ever.
Yeah.
Right?
It's interesting because as the release going out next week, Home Assistant have moved away from the term advanced. So there's no longer developer tools. They are just tools. Oh, there's no longer advanced options. It's just an option. I think that's the right step to take. And we just need to be clearer on the language. And along with all the other updates that I've mentioned before, you know, devices and automations specifically, I think we could get, if your mom or grandma just wants, when you walk into a room, the light turns on with a blueprint or with a pre-built automation based on what home business knows of that device, that could be pretty achievable. Advanced stuff, well, there will always be advanced stuff, right? It's always, you know, you can always go under the hood. And that's in everything, right? You can buy a drill from a hammer barn and I'm sure there's, you can just drill holes, but there's pretty fancy stuff you can do with some drill bits, right?
Do you think the option, the best option though, is we got to get better voice and you don't see the complexity. Like for the average person, they're setting these things up much like they set up their assistant, not to be named. Right. And it's like, hey, do these and do this. And it's voice enabled. You might have this home assistant dashboard under the hood that you would have access to. Most people are never going to get to it. They're just going to do their things, their automation things. And for those of us who want a dashboard, we might be able to go in. I don't know. Actually, the way AI makes the dashboards, we could get to a spot where I could be talking to it on a big screen and say, hey, make these things happen for me. And maybe it would.
Maybe the best smart home experience is one where you don't have to interact too much with the smart home. Like it should interact for you.
Yeah.
And you know, if you already have to open up an app to get to your dashboard or you have to fire up a voice command, in some respects, you've already failed, right? Then you're just remote control. You're not automating. You're just controlling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, interesting days ahead for this. What's coming up on the podcast? As you think about, over the next couple of weeks or months, what are you guys excited about from a podcast perspective?
Well, we've got a whole bunch of episodes coming out this week. Rohan's actually moving house, so he's going to be a busy beaver packing up his smart home, and then he's looking forward to starting from scratch. Right?
Oh, like, my God. That gives me, I'm getting hives right now.
Really? I'm quite jealous. So I'm like, I'd love to, you know, like I start from scratch and think about, you know, planning out all the devices to do again. Yeah. I'm quite jealous. We're turning 10 next year. So we have to think about how we're going to celebrate 10 years next year. Right. Thank you. Yeah, congrats on 15 years yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah.
So we're still interviewing for people. We're here. We're doing every release. So come check us out if you're interested in Home Assistant.
Yeah. If you like TJ and Gavin and Seth will be on next week. You're going to like what's going on over there at the Home Assistant podcast. A lot more geeky than this. You guys get down into the weeds.
We're going in the weeds. Yeah.
I try to keep it above the weeds. That's just where we've been, just to kind of, it's more opinion than it is anything else. But that's kind of what I like. Although there's some folks who say we get a little too weedy too. So, you know, whatever.
Can't please everyone.
No, and to each its own. But check it out, the Home Assistant podcast. And of course, all things smart home, even though you're trying to brush it off, it's out there as well.
It is out there.
Developing those as much. And make sure that's in your podcast player. Phil, can you hang out with me for 1 second while I close this
up?
Are you okay doing that? A couple reminders on the way out. If you want to join the Discord group, and Phil did that the last couple of days, jumped in the Discord group. You are there if you want to interact with them about this podcast and anything around Home Assistant. You can drop that in our Discord group, theaverageguy.tv/Discord. Love to have you there. It's not a very, right? You've been there a couple of days. It's not super noisy, right? I mean, it's kind of very manageable. There's really just about 50 of us that are interacting in there. And so it's pretty manageable. If you're afraid of like, I can't do another group, do this one. Come out and join us, theaverageguy.tv/Discord. You don't even, just lurk. That's what I do. I don't know anything. It's the smart guys in there that are talking about stuff. Don't forget theaverageguy.tv, both web and media hosting powered by Maple Grove Partners. Get secure, reliable, high-speed hosting from folks that you know and you trust. You know this Christian, he's doing a bang-up job over there. He keeps pinging me. You know, last time he was on, he was talking about the Bitwarden. You know, they're hosting Bitwarden instances up there where you can do that. And he's like, hey, are you going to get to that? And I keep saying to him, yeah, when you help me. So we haven't done it yet. I've got Christian scheduled for October 8th. Coming back, I should probably get it done before then. Seth Vault Johnson Warden
is fantastic. I would recommend Vault Warden. Yeah.
And I'm using it. I'm hosting with them at this point. He just wants to provide, if you want an extra layer of security, you know,
recommend.
You can do it there. So he's thinking about doing that plan. Hopefully, if you were interested in doing that, join him there. Seth's on next week. Adam Hickman in 2 weeks after that, a buddy of mine, he's been on before. I actually have to take some work time. I've got a work podcast I have to do here in a couple of weeks. So we'll be taking a week off. We are live every Thursday, 8 p.m. Central, 9, well, most Thursdays, 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern out here. Not even most lately, but 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern out here at theaverageguy.tv/live. Love to have you join us live. I saw Joe, Tony jumped in, somebody else. I saw a couple come in, and they must have come in through you, Phil. Geek Guru was jumping in here, and Net Benedict also jumped in on the restream. Thanks for coming out. Appreciate you guys joining us live. We'll be back next week with that. We'll say goodbye.
Where the screens glow bright and the Wi-Fi peaks. If you're looking for the tech talk you can actually keep, then settle on in with Home Gadget Geeks.